John, welcome to Radio Out There.
Thank you, Barry, and it's good to be here.
Now, you're talking about in your book, Man Unplugged, sort of men's journey in the 21st century and maybe a little bit before that as the fact that men aren't coping very well. Now, maybe some people would argue with that. Why do you say men are not coping well?
I think I was of the same view until I started to do the journey myself and then realised that I thought I was coping and realised underneath it there was a lot more frothing around that I was blissfully unaware of. And then as I started to talk with other men, hang out in men's groups and go to men's gatherings and conferences, I realised that a lot of men were facing similar issues.
Mm.
Then I started doing the research through Australian Bureau of Statistics and found things like, you know, suicide is the highest cause of death for men under the age of 44.
Now, they are shocking results, aren't they? You're saying there that five men die every day. And this is just in Australia.
Just in Australia.
And 140 others sort of don't manage to succeed in their efforts.
Correct.
Wow.
And to top that off too, we've got issues at the moment, Barry, with mental health services where I know of situations where men have finally found the strength to call a helpline only to not be able to get through because I think only 25% of calls actually make it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty tragic, and the more I researched, the more I read, the more I, you know, depression statistics, health statistics, the fact that more men die of prostate cancer than women die of breast cancer, those sorts of things were just quite shocking to me.
So is all this being swept under the carpet because, oh, well, you're a man, you're supposed to be up there, you know, man up, you know, what's the matter with you, just get on with life?
I think partly, and I think we've also been our own worst enemies. I certainly know from my own background and my own dad and other men that I've spoken with, you know, as men we generally don't want to go to a doctor until we're on our last legs.
Oh, no, that's for sure. Oh, you only go to the doctor when it's absolutely necessary. Yes. Oh, that's a typical male thing, isn't it?
It is. And so we're a silent majority who complain or suffer in silence, I would say. And it's only then when we realise that we're in deep trouble that we can reach out, and often, you know, as verified by the suicide statistics, it's a lot of men aren't coping with that underlying stress, and so they end up choosing an option that is for them simply the end of pain.
Yeah. Now, you've also said in your book that the social structure of men has changed dramatically in recent years.
Yes.
Can you qualify that a bit for us?
A man was often known by the work that he did, and that's where we drew our value.
Of course.
And as I mentioned, I think when we spoke before, that has changed with the global financial crisis. I've watched a lot of programs, particularly around what's happened for men in the United States. And post the global financial crisis, a lot of men lost their jobs. They would often stay at home looking after the kids, and their wives would try and go out and get work. So we're seeing a shift in demographic in the workplace.
Is this a good or a bad thing, though?
I think it's excellent that there's a more an egalitarian workforce happening, that women are being given, obviously, valuable opportunities to contribute to the workforce, and I think they make great impact in a lot of the companies that they end up working for.
So you're not saying that, oh, poor men, you know, stand aside women, you know, get back and start having babies and being barefoot and pregnant again?
Not at all. I think that There is a just like there's a radical masculist movement out there, there's a radical feminist movement out there as well, and I think that misogyny and misandry rule on both sides of that spectrum. And really the book was about trying to hold that middle ground and saying to men and women that this is the life of men, this is the inner world of men, these are the challenges that we face every day, these are the media stereotypes that we have to put up with, that if they were gender reversed, there'd be an absolute outcry and uproar.
Such as?
Well, for example, there's a group in America who founded a clothing brand called Throw Rocks at Boys.
Oh, yes, it was dreadful, wasn't it?
And it then became a $100 million business and an app for girls on an iPhone. And I just think, well, if that was turned around the other way, firstly, would it even be created as a clothing brand? And I don't think it would succeed.
Mm. And what was the purpose of it anyway? I mean, was it to try and cuddle up to girls and say, here, you know, we think blokes need a rock chucked at them? Or what? Just marketing or what?
Just marketing and tapping into the tween girl market that boys are just smelly.
That's right.
You know,
covered in boy germs, yeah.
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 And we see that a lot in the media. We've got either, you're either an Arnold Schwarzenegger character, the Superman, Hugh Jackman, or Homer Simpson, you know, and that's really the only roles that are being put forward. There are very few media images of men that are real and genuine about how most men actually are, and I think, again, we've been our own worst enemy in not standing up and going, hang on a minute here, this is not how we are as men. So
can you define what a real and genuine man is? Can we put that into words?
Yeah, and I'll borrow some words from Steve Biddulph, who's one of my heroes and mentors in this realm. I spoke with Stephen last year when I was writing the book, and I said, you know, how do you think we're going? And he said, I think that we're finally at the stage where we're now starting to produce young men with both heart and backbone. And for me, that term has resonated and sat with me for the last 18 months while I've been writing the book, that you will meet men in your life that have both heart and backbone, but they're fairly rare to find that balance.
That's very interesting from my own research and my own books. I have been told that the heart is where the soul actually joins the body and attaches itself to the body. So if you're connecting with your heart, you're also connecting with your soul in that instance.
Yes.
And that is something maybe that men haven't been doing, as having that soul connection, do you think?
We've been talked out of that because I believe that to connect with our soul, we really need to be aware of our senses.
Yeah.
So we need to be self-aware to the degree that we can actually feel what is happening within us. And during my unlearning, I guess you could call it, I had to firstly learn that I was actually having a feeling and feel what that felt like for me in my body. Then I had to learn to put a name to it, that it was either grief or sadness or anger or whatever. Anger, most men are pretty good at actually, but it's the more subtle feelings that we don't really are able to explain often within ourselves, and we don't know what to do with them.
So did your research say why this happens? Why we can't connect with our inner emotions?
I think it stems right from the beginning, pretty well when we're born. I know a lot of mothers that give birth to a son, their first reaction is often, oh my God, it's a boy, what do I do now? And as boys grow up, I don't think mothers relate very well to their sons and understanding sons' needs.
In what way?
I think it's organically natural for a woman who has a daughter to understand her daughter's needs because she's been there.
But what if she hasn't got any daughters? What if the firstborn is a boy and she has to cope with these new emotions? What then?
That's when it's difficult, and that's when dads can actually step in and fulfill a very good role. The belief that dads don't come into the picture until the boys are 8, 9 or 10, 11 years of age is a complete furphy.
Yeah.
My youngest son is just about to turn 6. We have had a phenomenal relationship since he was about 3 or 4 weeks old, when just in a moment of awareness with him, I actually connected with him at a very deep heart level, and since that time we've been almost inseparable.
And is this not happening, do you feel, with other families, that men are not connecting with their children, sons in particular?
Yes, because it requires a feeling awareness in order to be able to do that. And if the fathers themselves aren't self-aware and aren't aware of their feelings, then it's very difficult for them to connect with the feelings of their children. And I am actually seeing where I hang out in various places, in schools and sport and other areas, that there are a lot of what I would call underfathered boys, and Steve Biddulph writes about this extensively in Raising Boys. Maggie Hamilton's written about it in What's Happening to Our Boys. Celia Lashley's written about it in He'll Be Okay. Andy Roy's written about it in Raising Teenage Boys. There are a lot of people out there saying similar things, that there are a lot of underfathered boys at the moment who are simply lacking mentoring, male direction and leadership.
And how do we change all of this?
One way is for men to firstly recognise that we have a problem.
Well, surely most men would realise, if they're honest with themselves, that there is a problem in society today.
I disagree.
Okay. We're that divorced from reality and our own emotions?
Yes. A lot of men aren't able to be honest with themselves.
Yeah.
And certainly my experience, Barry, is that the first step that we have to take as men is that we have to stop kidding ourselves and be honest, brutally honest with ourselves in our inner thinking, that things aren't as we think they are, that they may be broken, or that we may be broken, and therefore we need to step outside of ourselves and get some decent support.
So what kind of behavioural attitude would that engender then? Is it not wanting to be with the family, rather being down the pub with the boys or going to the footy on your own or something like that? Or
these days it tends to be more work-related, I would say. I know a lot of dads that are workaholics.
Yeah.
They spend an enormous amount of time, and unfortunately the advent of modern technology, I mean, you know, you take your iPhone these days or your smartphone these days and you're never away from work. There's emails coming through, there's messages coming through, there's phone calls coming through. And I know people that I have worked with in the past who actually take their computers on holiday so they can clear their emails so that when they come back, they haven't got 1,000 emails to work through.
Yes, you mentioned that in the book, and I thought, gee, when I read that, that is so true, because I don't know about you, but I get about between 50 and 100 emails every day.
Yeah.
Well, if you go away for 3 or 4 weeks, boy, oh boy, you know, you spend a fortnight just catching up.
You do, you drown.
Either that or you say, oh, bugger this, I'm going to just delete the bloody lot of them.
Yeah.
And then people scream at you for not replying to them.
And then the classic is that wives often say, therefore, that their partners or husbands are therefore emotionally unavailable.
Well, what happens to working women in the same position? If you've got a mother and a father both working and they're both, well, they've got their head glued into a computer or an iPad or something, boy, well, that must create a lot of family problems.
Well, then you have underparented children that effectively are entertained through screens.
Yeah, which we're seeing a lot of.
I mean, Maggie Dent's been, I've seen Maggie speak a few times now, and she's an amazing advocate for children and talks extensively.
Maggie who?
Maggie Dent.
Margaret Dent. Yeah, Maggie Dent, yeah.
Yes. She's
sorry, I thought you had another name. I was going to say it's Maggie Dent, who's an actress friend of mine. I was wondering how she got into the thing.
Okay, yes.
But anyway, sorry about that.
Maggie's up your way at Mullumbimby, actually.
Oh, is she?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And a great advocate for children, particularly boys, and the things and type of stimuli that they need to get out and about. And she's changed a lot of families' dynamics and lives by giving them outside activities and getting kids off screens.
Oh, I must have a talk to her. Yeah,
she's amazing.
That's fair enough. Now, getting back to the attitude of father and son.
Yes.
I wonder how many women out there, particularly in a feminist movement, are sort of saying, well, hang on, you know, it's been a man's world, it's been a patriarchal society for hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's about time that all this happened. You know, poor men, suck it up, come on.
I wish it were that simple. Initially, feminism started as an equanimity movement. Where women obviously wanted to vote, wanted to have equal rights, and most of the men that I know support that equal view of life, that men can support women in becoming more equal in society, as women can support men as well. And I think that part of the problem for men at the moment is that the patriarchy has created a mess, but there's a generation of men that are trying to change it, and the problem that I'm seeing happen is that we are being labelled as being part of the patriarchy, and therefore we're also bad.
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? Particularly when we're seeing all these dreadful sexual things with priests and other people in abusing their duty of care and abusing children. And, of course, I guess 99% of them are male. So that doesn't help the image, does it?
Not at all. And what in particular, I mean, two events that I certainly remember distinctly, Barry. One was the murder of Jill Maher in Melbourne. And I was with a bunch of men shortly after that happened, and we had a lot of conversations around that. And the fact that men marched in the march against violence seems to go unnoticed, but the problem is that it takes one person to act in that way, and the media will latch onto that, and suddenly all men are tarnished with this one brush.
That's the problem, isn't it?
And it's a huge problem. So all the quiet work that's going on behind the scenes with men's conferences and men's gatherings, Men's Mental Health Week this week, a conference that happened in Sydney in the beginning of May on men's mental health and well-being, you hardly see them in the media. You've really got to keep your eye open, and it's almost, at the moment, strangely enough, like an underground movement.
I presume this happens in other countries as well.
Not so much. In fact, I realised only last year, talking with some people who do this, it was a conference in Brisbane that was an international conference, and we found out at that conference that, in fact, Australia leads the world in men's gatherings, groups, workshops and movements, and, in fact, southeast Queensland leads Australia by a country mile.
Really?
Yes, very strange. I don't know why it is, but the group that I hang out with up there twice a year are an amazing bunch. I think there's about 500 men in the organisation up there, and the gatherings that they run for over 100 men at each gathering are an experience for any man to behold. I would challenge that any man who listens to this interview to go along to one of their Manshine or manhood gatherings and not come away unchanged.
Now, one of the strong themes in your book is saying that we need to do, as a man, a lot more self-discovery.
Yes.
The self-identity problems that are there are things that need to be addressed. Now, you also then go on to talk about men's sheds and other men's work groups.
Yes.
Is that an integral part of the answer we're looking for here?
Yes. It doesn't matter what you do, as long as you do something. And it's not going down the pub and getting stonkered with your mates.
No.
It's about going and finding the company of good men that when they ask you how you are and you say, I'm fine, they will look at you and go, no, you're not. They'll call you on your stuff, not in an invasive or challenging or confronting way, but they let you know very clearly that in order to circulate and be a part of their group or their milieu, that you have to be real.
Is it a bit like an Alcoholics Anonymous group? Not that I've been to one.
But, no, I was about to say. No.
Neither of you, probably.
No,
but I'm wondering, you know, with that support within the group and the fact that we don't talk about it outside the group,
absolutely,
everything like that, is it a similar kind of theme?
It is. There is a camaraderie that takes place. There is a requirement for all men in those environments to turn up and bring their authentic selves. And for a lot of men, we don't know who our authentic self is.
Yeah, how do you find it, though?
Well, if you immerse yourself with other authentic men, you start to get mirrored back to you where you might be showing yourself as being unreal.
Yeah.
So when you put on the facade or the mask, a man who's been doing this for a long period of time can easily see behind the mask.
Mm. I think that's the other thing you mentioned on your website as well, that we do need to, as men, unplug from the stereotypes of a man.
Yes, absolutely. The media stereotypes of who we are supposed to be don't fit who we actually are. And I produced a workshop last year that at the end of it I have a 3-minute montage, and I did it at my book launch back in March. And this 3-minute montage is simply a collection of photographs of fathers and sons fishing, swimming, surfing, hiking, rock climbing, all these various activities with some beautiful music behind it. And in every time I've shown this, I think it's 4 occasions now, there's hardly been a dry eye in the house.
No, oh, that's great, isn't it?
Because it shows dads in a different light, and that's the light that I want men to be seen in, particularly those that love their kids. As I said in the book, Barry, I think women think about men's business and they think about, you know, a den of misogyny where men go and they bitch about their relationships.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's not what I experience. It's the opposite. It's men come and they talk about their families and they talk about their relationships and they talk about their children a lot of the time, and the pride and joy and connection they have with their children. And we're certainly seeing in family courts, for example, there's certainly more inclusion now of dads, but unfortunately a lot of that is still not resting well with some fathers.
Yeah, well, you were saying in the book, I think it's was quite disturbing, the fact that there's only something like 20% of all father-son relationships are what you would call, I guess, what, positive or on the mark or whatever?
Functional, yeah.
Functional, yeah, yep. That's a good word.
Yep. The rest I'm staggered at the amount of sons who don't talk to their dads.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sad.
It is.
But I
think I've got to go one further than that, because I know a hell of a lot of parents, mothers, whose daughters don't speak to them.
Yes.
So is this a general thing, and it's not just fathers and sons?
Oh, I'm sure it is, and I'm sure it's a lack of connection, but probably at a very young age.
Is it a generational thing, though?
I see gems of wisdom in each generation where families have somehow managed to maintain good functionality, that there's deep levels of trust and love and care within families. But I think they're becoming more the exception than the norm now.
Yeah.
You know, go back to you and my generation, Barry, where kids were let out on the streets. I used to ride my push bike from Gladesville pretty well all over Sydney. I never had a helmet.
No, of course not.
You know.
And you come home and drink water out of the hose in the garden.
Exactly, and, you know, eat the lead paint off my bedhead and, you know, all that stuff.
Well, we're still here, aren't we? Yeah.
And we're still here, you know.
I've seen those emails as well, yeah.
I think it was Maggie Dent who made the comment at a recent presentation that she did, that we mollycoddle our kids, particularly our boys, to such a degree that they just are not allowed to experience and fail.
Yeah.
I'm very fortunate. My sons go to a little private bush primary school here in Sydney that is amazing, and we had a school come visit us, and our kids are climbing trees up to quite high off the ground, because that's the nature of the policy of the school, is to let kids explore and find their limits, find their edges.
Oh, yes.
And one of the children from the visiting school turned around to their friend and said, I wish I could climb a tree sometime. And they were 11 years of age. They'd never climbed a tree.
Imagine not having climbed a tree. Oh, that's one of the great joys of youth. I remember climbing up, we had a lovely oak tree at the back of my place in Sydney, and I used to get right up as high as I could.
Yeah, how exhilarating and liberating.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So we're actually taking the opportunity for our children to grow up with any form of emotional resilience.
But it's far easier to let them sit in the corner and play on a computer or an iPad or something rather than saying, go out and climb a tree.
Yes.
And this is the sad thing.
It is a sad thing.
And it's reflecting in communications between people. Social media, I was reading the other day, is causing so many breakdown in communications between people.
Yes.
So it's not social media at all. It's social restrictions as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I have a goddaughter who tends to navigate her relationships by text.
Yeah.
And I said to her, darling, please.
Wake up.
Pick up the phone.
Yes.
Have a conversation with the person.
Exactly.
Because you can get all the intonations of language, you can understand exactly what they're saying, there's no room for misinterpretations.
Well, that's right. I mean, I remember years ago when I was lecturing in journalism, I had to explain to the students there are two languages. There's the written language and there's the spoken language.
Mm-hmm.
And until, as you said, until you have the right intonation, the right emphasis, the same words can be totally misconstrued.
Yes. And these days, you know, the 18 to 25 year olds are now breaking up by text.
I know, isn't that dreadful? Absolutely.
Wow.
Anyway, look.
Whole new spin on the Dear John letter.
Indeed, indeed. A couple of different things you addressed in the book. I'd just like to quickly go through them with you. I like the way you differentiated between the words male and masculine.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
I think there's been a lot of, confusion around that male and female are terms of gender and that masculine and feminine are terms of characteristics in terms of psychology.
Yeah.
And I think that if we could differentiate them more, we'd actually make life a little bit easier for all of us. That men are male and women are female, but that men and women both contain masculine and feminine principles within themselves.
Yeah, once again, it's getting down to this labelling that we're going on with, isn't it? And
yes.
It's far easier to label in a very quick text message than it is to actually talk and explain these things.
Yes. So for a man, for example, he has obviously his masculine aspect of himself,
yeah,
and he has his feminine aspect of himself,
yeah,
which I think it's Robert Johnson's, one of my favourite authors, he calls it the sword and the harp.
Ah, I love
it. And that a man needs to be a master of both,
yeah,
and which to use, when to use, and how much to wield.
Mm. And it's the same with women as well.
Exactly the same with women. The challenge for women, I find, though, Barry, is that where does a woman draw her masculine principle from in this day and age?
You mean where do they get the inspiration from?
Well, they can't get it from a man,
mm,
because a man's masculine is different to a woman's masculine.
Yeah.
So where does a woman actually draw what a functional masculine principle actually looks like? And I think a lot of women struggle with this, and that's,
yeah,
why you see women climb the corporate ladder in what they believe with a masculine persona.
And a masculine suit or something as well.
And a masculine suit, but it's actually not. It can be quite crushing.
Mm.
And women, when they do that, they tend to take on a persona that is not of them, and they lose the really wonderful feminine aspects of themselves.
Which is very sad.
And it's very rare, and I have met a few, and they're a delight to be around, that you can actually meet a woman who has both her feminine and masculine quadrants in place,
mm,
and you know exactly where you stand with women like that, but not in a crushing way, not in a vindictive way, not in a dominant way. It's simply, it's a woman who's at home, effectively, in herself.
Yeah. But how we achieve this, there's no easy answer, I guess.
No, I can only talk about it, obviously, as I have in the book, from the point of view of men. And based on my own experience of over two decades now, what we can actually do to go through that transformation process. And I think I conclude the book by saying it will be the most hellish and difficult journey and challenging journey that a man can do. But the rewards, when you come out the other side of that in terms of sense of purpose, sense of self-worth, sense of value, and sense of knowing why you're here, is unbelievable.
So what's the reaction been to the book so far, John? First of all, with women.
Wonderful. I had, funnily enough, a mother at our school who has a husband and three boys, two of which are twins, came up to me and said, "I've just finished your book." She said, "Thank you for writing it." And I said, "I hope you enjoyed it." She said, "I believed that I was very empathic towards men, and on reading your book, I realised that I actually wasn't."
That's a big admission.
Thank you for writing it. And I went, wow.
Yeah.
And that was the intention, was to provide women with an opportunity to understand what's really going on under the bonnet with the men in their lives, so that they can be encouraging, just as we as men can learn more about women and be encouraging of their journey.
Of course. And finally, what about the reaction from men who've read the book?
Some have found it quite challenging. One of the fathers of our school came up again and thanked me and said that he has a seven-year-old son, and he'd been leaving the parenting to his wife, believing that he would get on board when his son was 11, 12 or 13. And in reading the book, realised that, crikeys, I'd better get my hand in now and build a relationship with him well and truly before he gets there. So he's now changed his entire parenting model to be far more hands-on.
Yeah.
And that's what's needed. Dads need to be much more hands-on, particularly with sons, and take them out into the backyard and let them use the hand tools, and you know, take them in the car and show them how to change a tyre even if they get bored. But all that sort of life skill stuff is absolutely mandatory, I believe, for boys to grow up into good men.
Well, you said that at the beginning of the book, didn't you, that this is something that, that men used to do years ago with their boys, teach them how to change a tyre, teach them how to do various things, use a hammer, use a screwdriver and so on. And that's disappeared in recent years. How sad is that?
It has. And in fact, about 3 or 4 months ago, a little thing did the rounds on Facebook, and it was 100 things I want my son to know.
Mm.
And when you look down that list of 100 things, how to put water in a car battery, change wipers, change a tyre, use an iron, use a washing machine. There was like 100 life skills in this list, and I looked down them all and went, wow, what a fantastic list. And none of them are taught in school.
Yeah.
And very few of them are being taught at home.
Yeah. And this is the thing. I mean, we get onto a totally different subject there. What is school all about? Is it only learning about, you know, academic things, or would it be also good if we could have some life skills introduced in schools? But then again, are teachers qualified for that themselves? You've opened up a tin of worms there.
Yeah, that'll be another long conversation, I'm sure.
Maybe another book. Teachers Unplugged.
Education Unplugged.
Oh, yeah, that'll...
Oh, well, I'm very, very lucky that I've been on the board of my son's, two sons' primary school, which is 42 years it's been going now, and it is a, what they call it, a progressive primary school on 5 acres of bush with 65, 70 kids in it, where the kids don't have homework. They're on first-name terms with the teachers. They have no uniforms. And people outside of the school view it as a bit of a hippie school.
Is it working, though?
It's unbelievable. 40 years on, we've just done our first grant to do some research to track past students. And the results, I think it was typically around 30% of students who leave high school go into tertiary education, and we're sitting at 85%.
Wow. That says it all, doesn't it?
It does. It's their first long-term study. And the children in those environments absolutely blossom, because they're not being taught what to think.
Mm.
They're individually catered for in terms of their learning styles and learning speed.
Mm.
The educationalist, Sir Ken Robinson, asked a very fundamental question several years ago which really caught my ear, and he said, why do we believe that just because a child is born on a certain day that they should develop a certain level of skills by a certain age?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. John, thank you so much for your book, Man Unplugged, and also those encouraging words to both men and women, and, of course, to the generation that's coming up. I think this is needed to be written, and I wish you very well with it.
Thank you. I appreciate your time and the interview, Barry, and your interest.